Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Nobel laureate James Watson suggested that Africans are not as intelligent as Caucasians, the backlash came quickly, especially from the scientific community. We're joined today by three top scientists who have looked at race and intelligence, acknowledged differences in people from different backgrounds, and come to the conclusion that all brains are created equal. This hour on Point, what science does and does not tell us about race and intelligence. And joining me now from New York is Richard Nisbet, professor of psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan. He's author of The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. His recent op-ed in the New York Times was titled All Brains Are the Same Color. From Oxford, England, James Flynn, professor emeritus of political studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He's best known for discovering what's called the Flynn effect, the generational rise in IQ test scores over time around the world. His new book is What is Intelligence Beyond the Flynn Effect? And also from Charlottesville, Virginia, Eric Turkheimer, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He completed a major study in 2003 looking at class and IQ. Anytime you talk about race and intelligence, it becomes a sensitive conversation, but it's important to identify what's fact and what's relevant. Richard Nisbet, tell us what's at stake here. Why did the recent comments from James Watson, the Nobel-winning scientist, spark such a firestorm? What did he say and what did he imply?
Well, I'm not sure that I can quote exactly what he said. He certainly implied that there was a genetic difference between blacks and whites and one that was not likely to be overcome by the environment. Certainly that was the way it was taken by the popular press and by the public in general.
And it sparked a firestorm because people were resentful of that conclusion or that implication?
Well, I think it would be better to say people are terrified of that conclusion. People are extremely eager to hear that everybody is the same. For someone to assert that we're not the same and that we can never be the same with respect to some attribute like intelligence that everybody cares a lot about is frightening to people.
James Flynn, you did pioneering research into how IQ scores continue to rise with each succeeding generation, the so-called Flynn effect. How does that mesh or not mesh with Watson's comments and assertions?
Well, one thing we should make clear, no one is saying that all brains are the same. Within each racial group, some people are clearly born with a greater capacity than others. I'm quite sure that I could have had the musical environment of Mozart and wouldn't have composed his music. The real question is when you deal with groups. Now, of course, groups can be either ethnic groups or generations. And my research was of interest because one generation has a much higher IQ than the preceding one. And yet this difference is almost undoubtedly environmental. That is, in one generation, you don't get any selective breeding for genes. So it was proof that you could have huge differences between the generations that were purely environmental in origin. And that made people more inclined to believe that other group differences could be environmental, even though the IQ gap was quite large.
A lot of people believe that once you've established what an IQ is, that it isn't subject to change, but that's not necessarily true?
No, that's not true. For example, many developing nations at present are labeled nations that can't really develop a modern society because they have a low average IQ, let's say as low as 80. Well, our ancestors were lower than that in 1900 in terms of IQ, and yet we developed a modern civilization. And IQ is partially an effect of modernity. That is, once the Industrial Revolution occurs, it means that you need a more educated workforce. That pushes IQ up a little bit. That pushes economic progress further. Then you need, let's say, secondary education, and that pushes IQ up a little more. And then you have a little more economic progress, and then soon everyone is going to university. It's like going up a stepladder. That is, each increase in IQ paves the way for the next step of economic progress, and then another step of IQ, and away you go. And that process can raise IQ an enormous amount in a few generations.
And Eric Turkheimer, a series of articles at Slate magazine recently relied on research in part championed by white supremacists. How do you think articles like that play into people's founded or unfounded suspicions about race and intelligence?
Well, I think it's always a difficult thing for scientists or for the serious intellectual community, because on one level, I think Saletan had the very positive motivation of wanting to air out a serious intellectual issue and say, well, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of this. We ought to be able to talk about it. And that's of course true. And as scientists, we're all motivated to want to look at the data and see what they say. But then there's always the problem on the other side that by validating something like the hypothesis that Africans are genetically inferior in terms of IQ, in validating that as a scientific hypothesis, you can't avoid lending credence to it. To say that this is a scientific hypothesis and what we're doing now is waiting for the data to come in is a way of saying we don't know what the outcome is yet, and maybe it's going to turn out to be true. And to say that for Saletan, therefore, to have implied that as far as he was concerned, the jury was still out on the genetic basis of African IQ offended people for reasons that I understand. So it's, I think for even all of us here today, it's always a very delicate balance between wanting to take something seriously as an idea while still questioning, for me, whether it's ultimately a legitimate scientific question in the first place.
Saletan, the author of the Slate.com article, cited research on head size as that relates to IQ. James Flynn, what do you make of the studies that he cited?
Well, the head size issue, I'd just like to say two things. Even if you take the correlations between head size and IQ, they would indicate a black-white gap of only a few points, not the 15 points or so that exists at some ages today. So much is made of the head size data, but if you really gauged group differences by head size, they would be extremely small. The second thing is that there was a very interesting study in Georgia where they had huge samples, and in it black girls and white girls had the same head size. Now, that's not why I'm interested in it. What I'm interested in is the fact that that did not cut the IQ gap by even one point. So whatever causes the IQ gap between black and white, it doesn't look like it's head size.
In addition, I mean, isn't it true that the head size of women is different, substantially different from that of men, yet you can't draw any conclusions from that either?
Well, I think that's true. Of course, there is some indication that the neurons in women's brains are more densely packed than males. But that, of course, shows what a complex issue it is. We don't really have a good enough picture of the brain at present to tell why one person's brain is superior to another. I suspect it will have very little to do with head size, but will have to do with something like optimum blood supply to the brain. And we learn through dopamine being sprayed on parts of the brain that are active when we learn. And some people may have a better dopamine spraying system than others. But I can't believe that it's going to be anything as crude as just the number of neurons.
Eric Turkheimer, we hear all these reports of various studies, and it's hard to make sense of them all. They obviously overlap to a certain extent. Give us a sort of an idea. How much do we know about IQ and how it differs from racial populations?
Well, I mean, there are certain basics about IQ that are uncontroversial. It is a trait that's measurable in human beings. Exactly how it might be measured is sometimes controversial, but it is something that's measurable. When it's measured, it's an excellent, often the best predictor of human outcomes further down the road. So if you want to know how kids are going to do in school, an IQ score is probably the single best thing you could possibly know, and that's true of a great many things. It's also unquestionably the case that if you give IQ tests such as they are in the United States or elsewhere to African Americans as opposed to Caucasian Americans, African Americans score lower on those IQ tests. That's but that in and of itself, that's the fact that we're trying to explain. It's not the conclusion that anybody is trying to reach. So the question is not, do blacks score lower on IQ tests? That, unfortunately, is the case. The question is, why do they do that?
And another part of that question is, to what extent is it their innate intelligence as opposed to how they've grown up, their environment, and how they've been challenged?
Exactly. And, you know, it's important to recognize in that context that there's IQ tests have been around for a little bit more than a century, and they first appeared right around at the turn of the 20th century. And throughout that time, it has been the case that newcomers to the United States, immigrants, the impoverished people of the time scored lower on IQ tests. IQ tests played a very important role in the immigration debates after the First World War. And people very soberly discussed the scientific evidence back in those days about whether Swedes or Greeks or Jews or Italians had lower IQ scores, which they did. And if so, why? And were they genetically inferior in some way? And what strikes me when I think about that history is that what's happened since then isn't science. It's not like somebody did the studies to find out that, well, it turns out Greeks are really okay. It's just that as they become assimilated, the differences have gone away.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about race and IQ and about what the science tells us. We're talking with Richard Nisbett, professor of psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan. He is author of The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. Also, we're talking with James Flynn, professor emeritus of political studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He is author of a new book, What is Intelligence? Beyond the Flynn Effect. And also, Eric Turkheimer, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He completed a major study in 2003 looking at class and IQ. And Eric, why don't we start with that? Describe your 2003 study. How does it inform the current controversy, and to what extent are you drawing conclusions about how environment affects intelligence?
Well, okay, I'll have to back up a little bit quickly. But, one of the cornerstones of the whole discussion of genetics and intelligence is the twin study. So like many other traits, you can study identical and fraternal twins, identical twins who are clones of each other, absolutely genetically identical, and fraternal twins who are 50% genetically identical, like ordinary siblings. And by comparing how similar identical twins are to fraternal twins, you can get an estimate of the degree of genetic involvement in a trait. So identical twins are much more similar for height than fraternal twins, for example. Well, it very quickly occurred to people to use the twin method to study intelligence. And lo and behold, across a great many studies, identical twins are more similar for intelligence than fraternal twins, and that was an index of genetic transmission of intelligence. But the even more disturbing finding was that when you use the twin method to study not only genetics, but the environment, to ask, well, how much is family environment and neighborhood and poverty contributing to intelligence? The twin studies often looked as though the answer was zero, none at all. And those kind of data were the starting point for example, some of Arthur Jensen's work back in the 70s, arguing that, well, if the environment's not contributing anything, why would you bother with Head Start? Why would you bother improving the schools? Because it's not going to make any difference. So we found a data set that had something very unusual, which was a large number of American twins reared in poverty. Twin sets are usually based on volunteers, and so they don't include a lot of poor people who don't volunteer to be in twin studies. And what we found was that when you include the poor twins in the study, all of a sudden the environment looked much, much more important. In the poorest people in the study, environment completely dominated and genes hardly made any difference at all. And then as you moved through the sample, through the lower middle class, into the middle class, and a little bit above, the sample kind of ended there. The environment and genes lines crossed, and by the time you got to the upper middle class, genes completely dominated and environment hardly made a difference. So I think our study made the point that environments can matter, and they do matter, especially for people who are being raised in poverty.
Let's expand the conversation here. Let's take a call from Janine in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I'm calling with a question regarding the whole premise of IQ testing. It seems to me that the concept of IQ testing relies on the fact that the person doing the testing is actually the one that is in power. So the questions that come up tend to be from the majority or the Caucasian, and it may not be an accurate measure of intelligence for another demographic, for example, African-American community, Asian community, those types of things. And I speak as one who has, as an African-American, who has attained a doctorate degree in finance, which is typically thought of as a more difficult area in the business realm. So I probably would not have been deemed as IQ intelligent, but yet and still you're able to achieve these things despite what the majority would think of you in terms of your intelligence.
Thank you, Janine. Good question. James Flynn, what about it? Are IQ tests one size fit all? I mean, can you accurately?
It's not as simple as it appears. For example, IQ tests developed in America, when given in Japan, the Japanese did extremely well on them, indeed better than American whites. You couldn't give an IQ test, of course, to people in tropical Africa or sub-Sahara Africa. Often we're told, you know, they have IQs of 70 or 80. But these scores clearly show they haven't come to terms with the test because they don't behave like people with IQs of 70. They play cricket and they perform well in everyday life and what have you. So certainly when there are large cultural differences, you have to be skeptical about administering IQ tests. Now, within the United States, it is true that IQ tests predict university performance for African Americans about as well as white Americans. And that, I think, you have to take into account, that until the black-white IQ gap is made up, there is probably going to be a performance difference. I would just like to take up, though, where Eric pointed out that some groups have assimilated. Black Americans, in my opinion, cut the IQ gap with whites by a huge amount between 1970 and 1990. That is, they eliminated a third of the gap. And it seems to me pessimistic to assume that they may not eliminate the rest of the gap over the coming generations.
Richard Nisbet, you wrote in a New York Times piece that the research that's been done on race and IQ, your research that is, what can we glean from that, and can you go through what you covered in that study?
Well, the question I addressed is whether genetics contributes anything to the black-white difference. And there are various ways of looking at this question, but it's very convenient that there's a natural experiment that's gone on in the U.S., which is that the black population consists of about 25% European genes, which means that any given individual black could be 100% African up to primarily European. Well, if there's a genetic contribution to the black-white difference, then it ought to be the case that those European genes are an advantage for blacks. And we have many ways of looking at that question. And in all of those cases that we have, there's no evidence at all that you have an advantage by virtue of having European genes. Just take skin color, for example. It ought to be the case that lighter skin color reflects the degree to which you have European genes. And that's the case, but skin color is hardly associated at all with IQ, despite the fact that you might expect that lighter skin color would be a social advantage and might result in more opportunity. A second kind of study is, for example, the very smartest kids in a Chicago school system were looked at, kids with IQs of 140. These are geniuses. Now, if European genes are a tremendous advantage, then we would expect that these kids would be more likely to have white or partially white parents or white or partially white grandparents. And in fact, that wasn't the case. There was no difference at all in heritage. But maybe the most telling kind of study is on blood groups, where you can tell fairly well how African versus European the blood groups are of an individual. And it's no advantage at all for a black to have more European blood groups. So I think the evidence is pretty conclusive on the genetic side.
You've also done
no contribution.
You've also done a lot of research on the differences among Asians and Westerners, and what were you able to learn from that, and sort of give us an idea?
Well, First of all, just on the IQ question, and I haven't done that research myself, but in fact, Professor Flynn is the one who's done that research, and I would say that there is very little evidence that Asians are genetically superior to whites in IQ. I'll let Professor Flynn speak more about this, though, but what Asians have an advantage in is that they work harder, number one. Number two, they believe that you can change how smart you are by working hard. And this is – Americans have a very hereditarian view of this, how smart you are. And Asians succeed at a level that far exceeds what you would expect given their IQ.
Is that what your experience is, James Flynn? That
Yes, I studied Chinese Americans who either were born in America after World War II or came to America as small children. And I found that their mean IQ was no higher than white Americans, but they outachieved them enormously. And this clearly had to do with the family environment and with their aspirations. On the question of blacks, I think the most convincing piece of evidence in my mind is that Bill Dickens and I discovered, and I've detailed these results in my book, What is Intelligence, that the black-white IQ gap increases dramatically with age. In infant tests, it doesn't exist at all. By the age of 4.5, blacks are only about, pardon me, by the age of 4, they're only about 4.5 points behind. By the age of 24, they're 16.5 points behind. And that steady increase year by year doesn't resemble a genetic pattern. I mean, take boys and girls with height. They're much the same height up to age 13, and then there's a dramatic divergence. That is, the boys go right on to 18 and the girls fall off rapidly. That is, you find a dramatic break at something like puberty. The black-white IQ gap doesn't look like that kind of genetic effect. It looks like a cumulative environmental disadvantage that weighs in at about 6/10 of an IQ point a year all the way from preschool up through the age of 24.
Let's go to a caller. Colleen is on the line from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, James. I have a couple of questions. Can you please review the components of Western culture that fosters this desire for a measurement of genetic supremacy? And why do sciences focus on what populations cannot learn rather than learning? And when I'm speaking of learning, I'm talking about Western culture. From what your culture has, the mistakes your culture has repeatedly made. I'm outraged by the way in which my people, black people, are being discussed in this conversation because it indicates two things to me. One, a total difference in the humanity of people. And two, it indicates that white people as citizens on this planet have made no progress at all. The very fact that you spend 45 seconds discussing head size is alarming and medieval. Can you address these concerns? Thanks.
Eric Turkheimer, what's your response?
Well, I understand that. And, you know, I placed the current discussion of race that we're having here. All of us, of course, feel very well-intentioned in the context of very unpleasant now, distasteful discussions of American race that have gone on since the very beginning. And I believe that contemporary discussions of race and IQ belong right there with the discussions that were being had about Jews and Italians in 1925. I think they have the exact same moral value. I mean, if I allowed myself to back up one step, I mean, race is a great problem in America. We all struggle with race, and we all struggle with the fact that, you know, black children don't perform as well as white children in schools. And that's a great American question that it's natural that we would want to seek answers to. So I don't think anybody has to apologize for wanting to find answers to those questions. But I think all three of us here, in somewhat different ways, are here because we think that answers can be found to those questions through environmental intervention and change in the culture rather than attributing them to some fixed aspect of people's biology, which I agree with the caller is a horrible and ugly idea.
Richard Nisbett.
Sure. I think that it's very dangerous to say that it's medieval or wrong to have a discussion of any aspect of reality. You know, any time in the 19th century, if people had been forbidden to discuss racial differences, people would be far more racially biased today than they are. That is, the general trend of science has been to make people more enlightened about everything, including race. And it seems to me that it would be very dangerous to say, well, 2007, we have some unique historical knowledge, and we know that discussion of these issues from now on will do harm. We know historically that if we had ever done that in the past, we'd have done actually more harm than good by limiting discussion. I think you just have to trust that when science examines questions, however wrong-headed certain views may be, and however much people may be outraged by them, in the long term, science reveals reality, and by grounding morality in reality, we make progress.
May I reply to that quickly?
Certainly.
So my question for you, Jim, is, I mean, if you look at the changes in attitudes towards, let's say, Jewish and Italian people and Jewish and Italian abilities between 1920 and now, are those changes scientific changes, or are they cultural and ethnic, not ethnic, ethical and attitudinal changes? I don't think that what's happened is that scientists got around to studying Italians and found, well, how do you like that? It turns out that they're not inferior after all. It's that the culture changed. And so...
Well, the question is why the culture changed. Let us say in 1920 we had said, it's terrible to discuss why so many Jews run shops. And blacks, let's say, are accusing Jews of being shopkeepers that exploit them. And it was very useful for historians to say, look, Jews come from a background where they were prevented from owning land, where they were prevented from practicing the traditional professions. Of course, a lot of them ran small shops and had entrepreneurial skills. And of course, it was only natural these were carried over to the United States. There's no Jewish plot to run shops to, you know, exploit poor blacks and poor Italians and poor Irish. If you let science look at these things, you understand that these are natural historical developments. So I cannot think of any time in recent history where an open scientific discussion of group differences didn't in the long run benefit the groups in question. Now, an open scientific discussion means you have to tolerate the people on the other side. There's no discussion if it's just people on one side. And I think we have to get used to that. If we want the progress that free discussion brings, then we're going to have to listen to a lot of things that people find obnoxious.
I agree with you about the open part. I'm just not so sure about the scientific part. There needs to be an open discussion.
Well, I don't know. Science is part of open discussion. Then, if scientists are allowed to engage in the open discussion, then that's it.
Richard Nisbett, let me ask you quickly, we only have about a minute before the break. Looking forward, how many years away are we from understanding what genetic code predisposes someone to be especially intelligent?
Well, you happen to ask me a question that I don't have a right to an opinion on. I think even people who do genetic work will tell you that they have no idea what that's going to tell us or when it's going to tell us the answer to any of these questions. As far as I'm concerned, though, what I said earlier stands. I think that we do have substantial genetic evidence right now. I think the genetic evidence speaks with one voice. That is, it says that any IQ difference between blacks and whites owes nothing to genetics at all.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking today at the science of race and IQ. We're talking with Richard Nisbett, professor of psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan, and with James Flynn, professor emeritus of political studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand, and with Eric Turkheimer, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, who completed a major study in 2003 looking at class and IQ. Richard, let's pick up again with you. You wrote a book called The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. What was the thesis of that work? And maybe you can explain a little bit of how that fits into our discussion today.
Well, the thesis of the work is that there are very substantial differences in the way that Asians and Westerners think about the world and the way they perceive the world. And just briefly, Westerners tend to be analytic in their thinking processes. That means they focus in on some object, could be a person, that they want to achieve some goal with respect to. They look at the attributes. They use the attributes to categorize the object. They model the object and what they want to achieve using rules. And logical rules play a role in their thinking, formal logic. Asians have a much broader view of the world. They look at objects in relation to one another, in relation to their environment, in relation to the background setting in which they find themselves. They don't focus so much on rules and categories. They're concerned about relationships and similarities. They don't make much use of formal logic and reasoning about the world. Instead, they make use of what has been called dialectical reasoning patterns, which mean many things, but one of the things it means is that Asians, instead of assuming that two propositions which appear to be in conflict, one must be wrong, they say, well, let's look for the truth in both of these propositions.
Do you worry that you're sort of painting a broad brush of a population? I mean, and is that indicative of qualities that are strictly innate to Asians, or is it their environment and the way their culture had developed that created these?
Well, I would say we know it's not genetic because, again, we have a natural experiment here. Asians come to live in North America. So we can ask the question, do they remain Asian in their perceptions and in their cognition, or do they become American? And it's quite clear, they become American. In fact, it can happen in a single generation. But that doesn't mean that the differences are not pronounced unless you have this kind of cultural mutation of the differences that exist within Asia versus the what you find within the U.S. and other Western countries.
Okay, let's go to another call. Carl is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. What's on your mind today?
Well, I think that that the genetic aspects of it is good research and everything, but I think that the environment need to be looked, because I was very curious. To me, the research that one of your guests was talking about earlier about how the environment year by year up to 24, how different it is, how it just spread apart between African Americans and whites in America. And I believe that it is environment. I think more research need to be brought forth as far as that and why our environment is so different from theirs when we live in the same society and how we're that much apart. Thanks for taking my call.
James Flynn, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that is the key question. My book, What is Intelligence?, is not devoted to racial differences, but there is a chapter where I look very briefly at this question, and I think it's quite clear what happens. You find, for example, that black mothers, when they're pregnant, show less weight gain than white mothers. Now, that probably shows that they are less well-nourished. This is on average, of course. We're always talking about averages. But it probably doesn't do the fetus a lot of good if the mother is not undernourished. You find, for example, that in homes, that about 62% of black children are being raised in solo parent homes as compared to 23% of white. Now, there's nothing the matter with being a solo parent, but it does mean that the ratio of adults to children in the home is worse. That is, if you're two parents raising one child, it's much easier to stimulate that child, and there's the cognitive environment of adults talking to one another. If you have one parent with six children, well, it's much harder to devote time to each child, and of course the cognitive environment of the home is set by the children themselves. And once you get into school, there's at least some indication that when you have peer group culture, that many black youths feel alienated from the dominant white culture and develop a form of speech which is atypical English. Well, that, of course, will not particularly help you in school. And then finally, when so many black males leave school, it's more common to be in jail at some time between 18 and 24 than it is to be in a university institution. And jail is certainly not as cognitively enriched environment as being at a university, even a poor university.
Eric Turkheimer, let me ask you, do you have any discomfort in the way that scientific research is used to try and draw conclusions or inform the discussion about race and IQ and how they differentiate?
Yes, I guess it's been obvious. I have some discomfort with it.
Why?
I think it was one of the first things I said today, that when a question is given the status of a scientific question, I think it raises it to the level of being a rational idea as opposed, say, to a racial stereotype. So in a piece I wrote recently, I asked how, and you can sort of substitute your own ethnic group for this and whatever stereotype might happen to fall, but if, you know, how Jews would feel if someone announced that, well, we have a little program of research going here, and we're just trying to find out if Jews are more acquisitive for money and greedier than other people. And, you know, mind you, we're not anti-Semitic in any way. We're just collecting the data, and we're going to see what happens. Do we have to then, just because they've done that, and they're at a university somewhere, and they're giving out questionnaires to people, well, okay, that's a hypothesis like anything else, and we have to see it just like they're studying heart disease or something. And despite the fact that I'm a very strict believer in free and open inquiry in the scientific world, I do think it's possible to judge work like that as being fundamentally racially driven rather than scientifically driven, that research like that is founded on a racial stereotype. It's not founded on a legitimate scientific hypothesis. And that's a very, very difficult line for a scientist to walk. But I do think the very question puts us in a position where we have to walk it. And we have to always question, what is the basis for this? Is it really scientific?
And when articles appear in the popular press that raise these questions, it fuels the debate as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes it very...
Help but feel that whether scientists discuss them or not, they'll be discussed in the local bar. And if scientists don't debate the question, the only place in which it's debated is in the local bar. And however bad the scientific debate goes, it'll be improvement on what takes place without a scientific debate.
Mm-hmm. Raise the bar. All right. Well, listen, let's go to another caller. Paul is on the line from Buffalo, New York. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Okay. It's more of a comment. I'm a geologist, so I do have a sense of science. But what bothers me is the differences are commonly in peaks of bell-shaped curves with enormous overlaps. And then we're taking this multifaceted thing called intelligence, reducing it to a single number, and then judging people by it. And it just kind of drives me crazy that in our university system, it's let each person become all they're capable of being. And this, attributing racial differences, sometimes it seems to me it drives down the sense of possibility for people. And I've taught a lot of black kids. And, I've run into this problem of, in a sense, low personal expectation. That's kind of my comment more than a question. And that's it.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, if I could speak to that, I do have may I address that question?
Sure, go ahead.
I think that the raising of the issue in a scientific forum was unfortunate, I think it was raised by people who believed that there were genetic differences between blacks and whites, and then who felt, for whatever reason, that it would be useful for them to go public with this idea. And I do worry very much that it's had the effect of disheartening individual blacks. I mean, in fact, we know this. There are interventions that you can do that are very small interventions that have a big effect. You can tell kids. You can tell poor minority kids in junior high that we know that how smart you are is a function of how hard you work, and you show them pictures of neurons, dendrites growing toward one another. And kids will sometimes break down crying. They're so happy to be told that. And they improve their performance a great deal in school. So I think it's extremely unfortunate that it's become public. Now that it has become public, my role is to say it's not genetic. It's environmental. It can be changed. It is changing. And no one should be disheartened by the fact that there is a difference now. Let's just get cracking and reduce that difference.
Well, let's get back to the basics here again. Eric, maybe you can weigh in on this. How do you define intelligence, and what do the IQ tests tell us, and what do they leave out?
Well, discussions of what intelligence is always begins with the really kind of interesting fact that all ability tests relate positively to each other. So if we all sat down and came up with kind of some kind of paper and pencil puzzle that seemed to us to be some kind of measure of ability, some of them might be good tests and some of them might be bad, but on average, people who did well on one would do well on all of them. It's impossible, basically, to come up with a test that people who do less well on the SATs, they do better on this other test. It's not possible. People have tried and you can't do it. So the fact that all abilities go together leads people to conclude, well, there must be then this overarching construct that explains why all these things go together. And that thing has come to be called intelligence. Now, in my view, that's an enormous oversimplification, and it's way too easy to think that, well, because all ability tests go together, therefore there must be some gene or center in the brain or something like that that implies it. In fact, there are lots of other reasons you could come up with why different abilities go together. And Dr. Flynn, along with Bill Dickens, have worked up some very interesting models where that happens entirely because of the environment. It doesn't have anything to do with genes in the brain. So there are a lot of reasons why tests go together, but tests go together, and that's what is called intelligence.
You know, even if we put the worst face on it, there's a genetic difference between me and an Olympic champion. I don't think, however hard I trained, I could beat an Olympic champion at 1,500 meters, though I'm pretty good. But if he only runs because of external compulsion and gives up running when he graduates from university, and I go right on running, I'll beat him all hollow within a few years. The brain is much more like a muscle than we ever realized. And I was thinking of your educator. What every child should realize is that race has got nothing to do with an individual. There's no such thing as a black individual. An individual is what they are. And if they try hard, they will make the most of whatever capacity they have, and they'll surprise themselves. It's when people give up that they are in trouble. And as I say, I couldn't beat an Olympic champion on pure physiology, but I'm still running at 73, and most of them aren't. And I can beat them today.
Richard Nisbett, you know, a lot of the research that we're talking about today and that has been cited recently is not new. So why does this controversy seem to never die?
Well, I think it's because there is a sort of an IQ industry of people who have a certain set viewpoint. That is, they feel that IQ, intelligence, is substantially hereditary, and that it's hard to change. And some of these people believe that, partly because of the strong heritability of intelligence, that group differences also are heritable. So the position exists out there. People are aware of it. It was made extremely well known by the book The Bell Curve by Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein. And I'm afraid that book gave kind of credence to the view that race differences in IQ had a genetic basis. And that escaped really through the intellectual community, the scientific community, and there were very few people on the other side who were meeting that. As I say, I feel the evidence is very strong against any genetic contribution, but there certainly are people in the IQ field who believe that that the differences are genetic.
Just quickly back to James Flynn, what happens when we do learn more about these differences between people? Where does science go from here?
Well, one of the things is, imagine that we had banned the bell curve, but we didn't. And I, through reading that book, was led to examine very carefully its most discouraging thesis, and that is we were developing a lower class in America that would be cognitively unable to make any contribution to our civilization. And after I looked at that in great detail, I found two things. That first, lower class people in America, their children do not have a growing IQ gap on the middle class. And secondly, I found that when I did some social modeling, I found that probably we never would develop an underclass that couldn't be educated. I mean, I think we're going into a period when we have no excuse whatsoever for writing off any sizable group of Americans in terms of their educability.
Okay, James Flynn from Oxford, England, Eric Turkheimer, who was joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, and Richard Nisbet, who was in New York today. We thank you for being with us. You can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you to the guests. I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.